I'm going to do in the next few lectures. And the last thing I talked about was how integration by parts works in GR. And one context where that comes up is varying the action to find the equation of motion for a field. So let's work out the case of single field slow roll inflation, this action. Suppose I want to find the equation of motion for the phi field by varying the action with respect to that field. So what I like to do is just, rather than plugging into the Euler-Lagrange equations to actually vary the field and do the integration by parts by hand. So what would happen here, if I'm just varying with respect to phi, then the first term goes away. Of course, we'll also be interested in varying this action with respect to the metric to find the equations of motion for the metric, but we'll talk about that separately. So if I vary this with respect to phi, then there's nothing here. This term, you know, let me write it like this. So I'll make it a little clearer. Then I get two terms. So the 1/2 goes away. That looked like this. And if I vary this term with respect to phi, I just get this. And then I want to integrate by parts to take the derivative off and write this in terms of delta phi. And in this example, there is no curvature term appearing in the integration by parts. And you can just bring it through, turning the minus into a plus. And so you read off the equation of motion, setting the expression in brackets to zero. You read off the equation of motion, which is that the covariant Laplacian of phi is v prime of phi. Now that's actually what you would have guessed naively based on flat space intuition and the usual Euler-Lagrange equations for varying an action. But in more complicated examples, the reason this works is because the integration by parts in general relativity goes through the square root minus g and the d mu nu, so to speak. In more complicated examples, something more complicated might happen when you do that integration by parts, such as picking up a curvature term. So I like to just go through the steps by hand. Anyway, this is the equation of motion of the phi field, of the inflaton in single field inflation. Of course, the delta squared here is the 4D Laplacian or Klein-Gordon operator. This is the covariant version of a scalar field rolling down a hill in a curved geometry. Now let's talk about varying the action with respect to the metric to get this stress-energy tensor and Einstein's equation. So this can be confusing because of notational subtleties. Sometimes the stress energy tensor is written this way as the derivative of the matter action only with respect to the inverse metric. But I like to, I think you usually see this written L. I like to do that functional derivative by hand, do the integration by parts by hand. So the way that you might think about this is that if I vary the matter action with respect to the metric, I aim to write the result as something multiplying the variation of the inverse metric, where the something by definition is minus 1/2 the stress energy tensor. What makes doing this variation tricky is the notation, mostly the notational subtleties. For example, suppose you're varying with respect to the metric, and this covariant derivative appears. Then you might say that that's zero. If I'm just varying with respect to the metric, not varying with respect to phi, of course, and that's correct. Whereas if I varied That's correct, because to take the covariant derivative of a scalar function with the index in the lower position, I just did an ordinary partial derivative, and there's no dependence on the metric. But if I were computing this, then with the upper index, this really stands for g upper mu nu times the partial derivative. And then if I vary with respect to g, I pick up the delta g upper mu nu. So these look like they would be related by these look like they're related by just raising or lowering an index. And so you might think if that if one is zero, you can raise the index to conclude that the other one is zero. But that's not right. And the way to avoid getting tripped up by the notational subtleties is just to remember that the delta doesn't commute with the raising and lowering of indices, because the raising and lowering of indices involves a g mu nu, and that has to get delta'd. So you know, as another example, it's just really easy to make mistakes, like you know, an expression like this is not equal to an expression like this, for example. This is a case where I tried to commute raising and lowering the indices with the delta. Sorry, I should have. What I meant to write was this. These two expressions are generally not equal. Here's a particularly obnoxious one, which often comes up, that you might think that I'm trying to vary the action and write the result proportional to the shift in the inverse metric. And suppose that the non-inverse metric appeared in the action, then you might think that that is given by this. Might think that the variation in g lower mu nu is just given by lowering the indices of the variation in g upper mu nu. But there's actually a minus sign here. That's something that's not supposed to be obvious, but it follows by delta-ing both sides of this equation that says that the two metrics are inverses of each other. If I delta both sides, you know, if paying careful attention to the index positions, I'm not raising and lowering inside of deltas. I get zero on the right-hand side because delta mu nu is just either zero or one, no dependence on the metric. And then if I rearrange if I put in, I want to get delta g with the lower indices by itself. So if I bring this term over and then put another factor of the lower metric to remove this, then I get this. Which is what I was trying to show. So this is worth remembering. There's one more little formula that you often need when varying actions with respect to G. And that is a formula for the variation of the square root minus g with respect to the metric. Let me remind you that the way that you, if you ever need to take the derivative of a determinant, where the delta here could be any sort of, it could either be a variation with respect to something, as in this example, or any sort of derivative operator, like a partial derivative or a derivative with respect to time, Bay is a time-dependent matrix, the general formula is this, and the only reason this isn't like a standard formula that everybody knows, like the product rule for differentiating the product of two things, is that we take calculus before we learn about determinants usually. But this is something that, this is called Jacobi's formula, and it's something that should be in your, as physicists, we spend a lot of our lives doing algebra and we have to have a bunch of tricks memorized, and this is something that should be in the list of memorized tricks. Okay, so let's, using this, let's vary the square root of minus g with respect to the metric. So this is the variation of, let me first write it as minus g to 1/2 minus g to the minus 1/2 times minus delta g. And then g means the determinant of g lower mu nu. So I can write that as by the formula the determinant times the trace of g inverse delta g. Let's see, restoring the indices. Restoring the indices, I can write the trace of g inverse delta g like this. Now I want to end up with the result proportional to the variation of the inverse metric. So to trade delta g lower mu nu for delta g upper mu nu, I can do that, but I pick up this minus sign. Right. Let me put the minus sign in here. A little more clear. Okay. So with those little algebra tricks in mind, let's vary the action of single field slow roll inflation to get the stress energy tensor. Oh man, this one's about to go. If we lose both blackboards, we're screwed. All right, really small. Okay, so remember to calculate the stress energy tensor, you take the matter part of the action only. So now if I vary with respect to the metric, I get two pieces. So when I vary the square root minus g by the previous calculation, I pick up this, just in front of the square root minus g. And then there's a term where I vary this g mu nu. That gives me minus 1/2 delta g mu nu. Delta mu. Delta nu phi. And then in this step, I'm just reorganizing. Here, there's no integration by parts to do. And then this expression in brackets is Now I can read off the stress energy tensor. Whatever appeared in front of the variation of the inverse metric is minus 1/2 T mu nu. And so the result of the calculation is the following stress energy tensor. Oops, I started screwing up coefficients halfway through. Okay. And of course, the reason for calculating the stress energy tensor is because you want to know the equation of motion of the metric, which is just given by Einstein's equation with the stress energy tensor on its right-hand side. So in general, calculating the stress energy tensor is no big deal. You just have to be aware of these notational subtleties and have this formula for varying the square root minus g. Okay, that's the end of my GR review. Now I want to talk about the physics of inflation. We already derived during the GR review the equations of motion for the inflaton and the metric in a covariant form. Where T mu nu is. So let's specialize these to the FRW metric. So one thing that happens in the FRW metric is that phi is a function of t with no x dependence. I'm talking about the FRW metric without perturbations in the fields. I'll talk about the perturbations next. So this should maybe be the background solution. So the FRW metric let's start by writing the stress energy tensor in the standard FRW form. If you write this out, you'll find that the FRW metric has, well, let me try to work it out. So T mu nu is, with the lower indices, so the first term, I have a phi dot squared here and zero everywhere else because phi doesn't have spatial derivatives. In this term, I get the squared gradient of phi is minus phi dot squared. And then I have a g mu nu, which looks like minus 1, 0. And then I have minus v times g mu nu, which is minus 1 a squared delta ij. So putting all the pieces together, I get 1/2 phi dot squared plus v up here. Oh, this should have been a squared delta ij. Minus 1/2 a squared. Let's write this as minus a squared 1/2 phi dot squared minus v delta ij. And so as expected, The FRW metric, sorry, this should be a plus. The FRW metric came out, or the stress energy tensor came out in its standard FRW form with energy density 1/2 phi dot squared plus V and FRW pressure 1/2 phi dot squared minus V. So the kinetic energy of the field, the 1/2 phi dot squared, is a component with equation of state W equals plus 1. And the potential energy is a component with equation of state W equals minus 1. So the equation of motion for the metric would just be given by Friedman's equation with the rho on the right-hand side. And then there's also the equation of motion for phi. This is the equation of motion for A. And then there's also the equation of motion for phi, which we wrote in this covariant form. And to specialize it to FRW, we'd like to have an explicit formula for the Laplacian in the FRW case. And so I worked that out by making it a homework problem where I asked you to show that there's a particular form of the Laplacian which you can work out and plug in and get this equation. So this is an equation. This is the equation of motion for phi of t. Given on the homework. So these are the equations of motion for the inflaton rolling down its potential, at least the background part of the solution with no perturbations. And these are easy to integrate. The way that you would integrate them is if you think about integrating this equation first, then the h that appears is a function of phi. So if you plug that in, you'll have an equation that just involves phi and its derivatives. And that's an ordinary differential equation that you can get integrate to get phi as a function of t, a nonlinear differential equation. And then once you've integrated that to get phi of t, then you could plug in to get h as a function of t and integrate that to get a as a function of t. A more numerically convenient way of doing that would be to change variables in the second equation so that log a is the time coordinate. This is what's usually done. You can change variables in the differential equation from time to a by just sticking in factors of h. And then if you unpack those factors of h, you'll get an equation for phi, an ordinary differential equation for phi as a function of a that you can integrate. And then once you have phi as a function of a, now you know the Hubble parameter at every a, and you can integrate to get time as a function of a, or log a. The same way in one of the tutorials where you computed the age of the universe by integrating over a. So these equations are pretty simple to think about, but they're nonlinear and can get kind of messy. The case that will turn out, this isn't obvious in advance. The case that'll turn out to be relevant is the slow roll case where the potential is nearly flat. So I want to say what that is. The second term in the equation of motion for phi with the h in it is sometimes called a Hubble friction term. It looks like the friction term in if I just have like a classical ball rolling down a ramp, and it has some equation of motion with a friction term. This looks like a friction term that says that the expansion rate of the universe wants to pin the field on its potential and not let it slide down. Now, for a classical particle rolling down a ramp, if the friction is small, this is a second order differential equation. But in the limit where the friction is large, then your physics intuition would suggest that what happens is that at first the particle accelerates and it behaves as a second order differential equation. But then it quickly equilibrates to a situation where the friction term is nearly canceling the force term. In other words, the equation of motion is well described by a first order differential equation. So slow roll inflation refers to a potential which has a similar property that the Hubble friction term in this equation is large, and the second order different equation of motion for phi is well approximated by a first order version. So I want to show you how to derive the technical conditions on the potential V that make the slow roll approximation accurate. And I think a nice way of formalizing things is as follows. So I'm going to say that the slow roll approximation to the equations of motion is this. So I'm assuming that the Hubble friction term in the second equation is much larger than the acceleration term. I'm also assuming in the equation for h squared that phi dot is small, that this is slowly rolling. That will also happen in the limit of large friction. So let phi, when I write an equation with an SR subscript, I mean the exact solution to the slow roll equation of motion.
Is it clear at this point why is that we need the slow roll condition?
Oh no, so it'll turn out that, but only at the end of the calculation we'll be able to see that if you're outside of the slow roll regime, then you won't get the nearly scale invariant power spectrum. So I'm not sure about the history and what generality the calculation was first done. But now that we've done the calculation and we know that this is the regime that'll be observationally relevant, we can talk about making this approximation from the outset. I want to ask the question, under what conditions is phi well approximated by phi slow roll? What conditions on the potential will make that true? And I'll answer that in a second. First, I want to point out that the reason why slow roll is very nice, why it's very convenient to replace the second order differential equation by the first order differential equation, is that in the slow roll approximation, any quantity can be converted to local derivatives of phi, of V. What do I mean by any quantity? Well, here's some examples. If I'm making the slow roll approximation, that is, I forget about the exact second order differential equations of motion and pretend that these are the whole story. If I'm interested in phi dot, for example, then by the first equation, I can write that as minus V prime over 3H. And then by the second equation, I can replace the h by v to the 1/2 and get m Planck v prime over 3v to the 1/2. If I'm interested in phi double dot, for example, then let me take the time derivative. I worked out phi dot. Let me take its time derivative. So first I'll differentiate with respect to phi, and I get the following. I decided to write the answer like this. And then I need a phi dot. So let me write that as phi dot slow rule. And then if I plug in this result for this phi dot and collect terms, I get the following. So basically, all quantities of interest, whether they involve derivatives, can be converted to some combination of local derivatives of the potential. That's what's nice about the slow roll approximation. Basically, a first-order differential equation, you don't care about the history. Like the velocity at a particular time is just given by local expressions. So you don't need to integrate anything to get a formula for that like this. In a second-order differential equation, you'd have to do some integrals. Just as it'll be useful to have this formula on the board, h is just given directly by this formula. And I could do the same trick if I wanted h dot or h double dot, et cetera. Okay, so with those expressions, I can now answer this question. If I want to know what conditions on phi will make the slow roll approximation accurate, what I could imagine doing is first computing the slow roll solution, phi SR, and then thinking about the extra terms in the equations as perturbations. And I want to ask under what conditions those perturbations are small. So for the first equation, I would want one-half phi dot squared to be much less than v. And this can be evaluated on the slow roll solution. Let me title this conditions for phi to be approximately phi slow roll. And then I want the phi double dot term in the phi equation of motion to be small compared to the Hubble friction term. Because everything here has an SR on it, I can plug in these expressions and figure out what the conditions are. So the first condition reads, the constant prefactors aren't important here, but I kept them in just for fun. And then the second equation would be like this. This should have had a dot. Okay. Now, it's conventional to introduce this notation, just to rewrite these in a cleaner way. Let me define the slow roll parameters epsilon to be Planck squared over 2 v prime over v squared, and eta equals m Planck squared v double prime over v. Those are just definitions. In terms of those definitions, this equation becomes, the top equation becomes epsilon over 3 is much less than 1, and the bottom equation becomes eta minus epsilon over 3 is much less than 1. Of course, taken together, those are equivalent to just saying both of these parameters, epsilon and eta, are much less than 1. So these are the, this is the technical definition of flatness, or of a slow roll potential. Both of these derivatives have to be small, or the first and second derivatives of log v have to be small in Planck units. In general, expressions like this that are exact in the slow roll approximation can be expanded. Those are the leading terms in an expansion in powers of epsilon and eta. That's how the slow roll approximation works. One final comment is that the equation of state is given by this. That's P over rho. And if you work this out to first order in the slow roll expansion, that can be done with the formulas that are already on the board, and I leave it to you to show that this is true. So one way, another way of thinking about slow roll is that the expansion is close to W equals minus 1. Actually, slow roll is a little stronger in that that's equivalent to smallness of epsilon, and we need both of those parameters to be small for slow roll. Okay. Great. So now I want to start. I like this side. Oh, I can't raise this board. Okay, I guess I'll raise this one. So that's all I have to say about the background solution in inflation. And now I want to start talking about perturbations. We're going to start one of, at least according to my taste, one of the most interesting calculations in all of physics, which is showing that single field slow roll inflation generates fluctuations starting from the vacuum state of the theory, and that those fluctuations have the Gaussian random, nearly scale invariant form that we need to explain observations. So this will be a long calculation that will involve some QFT and some very heavy-duty GR. By the way, in general, there's no problem mixing relativity, general relativity, and quantum field theory, as long as you're working at tree level. And this will be, entirely be a semi-classical tree-level calculation. It's only when you get into loops that you need to loop corrections that you need to understand quantum gravity. So what we're trying to do is conceptually simple. We want to take the action of single field slow roll inflation and analyze its fluctuations. So we've analyzed the background solution with no fluctuations. Now we want to put in fluctuations in the metric and phi, expand the action in those fluctuations. The result that we'll get, expand it to second order. The answer will turn out to have a simple form. Let me write it down in advance. Where zeta and gamma ij will be defined later. Their definitions will emerge during the calculation. That's the classical part of the calculation and involves a lot of GR. Then we'll need to do the quantum part of the calculation where we talk about the quantum mechanics of a free quantum field theory. It's a free theory because it's the action is just quadratic in the fields. And analyze that field theory and compute the perturbations that are generated. Now this is a rare example, maybe, of a calculation where the classical part of the calculation is a lot harder than the quantum mechanical part. Getting from here to here is a big mess. Once you get here, working out the quantum mechanics is actually not that big of a deal. Now, if done by brute force, in principle, we could do this by brute force. I mean, everything here is just some explicit function of phi and g. Like R is some complicated nonlinear function of g mu nu. And so we can try to expand to second order in the fluctuations and get this result. So brute force is one approach. And if you do it that way, I would estimate that it's maybe like 20 pages of algebra. So one approach, now standing in front, watching someone do algebra, brute force algebra at a blackboard is not very interesting. So that's would not be a good use of lecture time. So one approach, and in all honesty, what I've done when I've had to teach this in the class is to do part of the calculation and then just give up. You start, and then you say, you guys get the idea. From here, you can show dot, dot, dot that this is the answer. Never mind that the dot, dot, dot was like 17 pages of algebra and I only did the first three. What I'd like to try is something different. So I think that there is a way of getting from here to here, which is conceptually interesting. Doing algebra at the blackboard can be useful if there's something conceptually interesting about it. And I do think it's possible to get from here to here to factor that calculation as a bunch of conceptually interesting pieces. So along the way, like one piece will be learning about the ADM variables and the Hamiltonian formulation of general relativity. Another conceptual piece will be a general discussion of perturbing one metric around another in general relativity. So I'm going to sort of alternate between like general conceptual things. The calculation will just sort of be an excuse to show you some interesting things in GR. So I'll sort of alternate between showing you interesting things in GR and then showing you how those things can be applied to do a step in the calculation, and then we'll eventually get here. It's interesting that the starting point and the ending point are both so simple, but the steps in between are so complicated, and there just doesn't appear to be a way of getting from here to here that's not a lot of calculation. That does make me wonder if I'm missing something. Calculation seems to depend on a lot of magic cancellations that sort of conspire to reduce some big intermediate answer into this small final answer. So be on the lookout. I think it'd be quite interesting to me and other people if there were a simpler way to do this calculation. I wonder if it exists. So as we go through, if you have any ideas for a way that maybe it could be done more simply, let me know. Okay. So I want to start by talking about just some general results on perturbation theory in GR. I'm going to start out super general, and let's say G and G bar are two arbitrary metrics. I'm going to be interested in the case where G bar is a simple metric, like an unperturbed FRW, and G is some small perturbation. At first, I'll just assume these are two arbitrary metrics that don't need to be close to each other. So here's a useful piece of GR trivia. The difference between two connections is a tensor. The difference between is a tensor. And the reason that's true can be seen from the transformation law for Christoffel symbols. The Christoffel symbol is not a tensor. It has this special transformation law. So the Christoffel symbol's transformation law looks like this. There's this piece, which is what you would expect if it were a tensor. And then there's this piece, which is a contraction between first and second derivatives. If I take the difference, from this you can see that if I consider the difference of two sets of Christoffel symbols, and they each have this transformation law, then in the difference I'll just have this term, and this term will cancel. So let's write plus zero unit. Where C mu nu is a tensor. C mu nu rho is a tensor. Now, I want to find a formula for some sort of covariant formula for this object C. Because I'm trying to understand how, when I perturb a metric from G bar to G, I want to understand how all objects are perturbed. I'm going to do the Christoffel symbols first, then I'll talk about the curvature and so on. So if you write out the definitions of gamma and gamma bar, the formula for the Christoffel symbol with, you know, G or G bar in it, and subtract them from each other to get C, and then rearrange a bit, then you can write, well, there's a few different expressions you can write down. You know, in general, one thing I should have warned you about in advance, when we do GR with two metrics, that we get into this like notation, this situation of notational ambiguity, where if you're raising and lowering indices, you have to say which metric you're using. There's a few different formulas that you can write down, but I think I like this one the best. Which expresses the tensor C in terms of barred covariant derivatives of the unbarred metric. So I'm using the unbarred metric to raise the index here, but the barred metric to take the covariant derivatives. I'm going to make this, I haven't assigned homework 2 yet, but showing this will be a problem in homework 2. You can start from writing down C in terms of ordinary partial derivatives and then rearrange to, there'll be some terms that look like derivatives of G, and there'll be terms that look like products of two Gs. And you can rearrange things to make it look like covariant derivatives instead of ordinary partial derivatives. So one thing that's nice about this expression is that Built into it is the fact that C is a tensor. Since everything on the right-hand side is a tensor, you know, when I take the covariant derivative of one tensor, I get another tensor. When I contract with a tensor, I get another tensor. This formula shows explicitly that this is true. Notice that barred derivatives of the unbarred metric don't have to be zero. If there were no bar here, the covariant derivative would have to be zero by the metric compatibility of the covariant derivative. Okay, so that's how the Christoffel symbols are related. Let's look at how the curvatures are related. So the Ricci curvature here I couldn't decide. There's some choice when trying to derive an equation like this. Like, you start with something that looks like a big non-covariant mess, and then you wrangle it into a covariant form. There's some choice as to whether you use like barred covariant derivatives or unbarred ones. For the Ricci curvature, I couldn't decide which formula I like best, so I'll write both of them down. You can use this formula in which the covariant derivatives are barred, or this formula in which they're unbarred. By the way, these formulas, let me finish writing and then I'll make a comment. These formulas look a lot like the standard formulas for the Christoffel symbol gamma in terms of partial derivatives of the metric. You can see that all that's been done here is, if I take the usual formula for the Christoffel symbol gamma in terms of partial derivatives of the metric, and then replace those partial derivatives by a different covariant operator, in this case gamma bar, then I get the formula for C. And analogously, this formula for R minus R bar looks just like the standard formula for the Ricci curvature in terms of the Christoffel symbol gamma, but with some partial derivatives replaced by appropriate covariant derivatives. The second one is one thing that's nice about the second formula is that if I want to compare the Einstein-Hilbert actions, I should have said that this is also, showing this is also a homework too. Full disclosure, this calculation is going to involve a few pieces that are exercises in brute force algebra. So rather than do those at the blackboard, I decided to make them the content of the second problem set. So if you want to compare the two Einstein-Hilbert actions, here's the Einstein-Hilbert action for G. The second formula here is nice, the second formula for R, because if I plug it in, then these middle terms will go away by integration by parts. Now you have to be careful with this because it's important for the calculation that everything involves the same metric. Like the covariant derivative here is a unbarred covariant derivative. The square root of minus g is unbarred. The g mu nu is unbarred. Because everything's unbarred, then the integration by parts works. And you just get this answer. Square root of minus g, g mu nu, r bar, minus
bar.
Oh, yes, thanks. Right. One comment here is that if the barred metric that I'm perturbing around is flat, if g is flat, then the curvature is first order. In delta g, which is g minus g bar. But the Einstein-Hilbert action is second order. So at SEH equals SEH bar plus corrections of order delta g squared. The reason that's true, you can see that from the formulas. If in general, this curvature, if I perturb in powers of delta g, then c will be first order in delta g. That will give me first order terms here. But when I put them into the Einstein-Hilbert action, they become zero by integration by parts, and I just get terms that are second order. The conceptual reason that's true is that, so this statement is true because if I have a flat spacetime like Minkowski space and I put in mass, I get potentials that are proportional to the mass, not the square root of the mass. You could think of the potential in the metric as being a potential and the perturbation in r mu nu as being the mass as being stress energy. By Einstein's equation. So that makes physical sense. This is true because when I perturb the metric, remember the variation of the Einstein-Hilbert action, if I perturb the metric, looks like the Einstein tensor times delta g mu nu. And the Einstein tensor is just the curvature of the metric that I'm perturbing around. So if that were flat, then this would have to be zero to first order because the curvature is zero. The only way these statements can be consistent, that the curvature is a first order quantity but the Einstein-Hilbert action is second order, is if the first order terms are covariant derivatives so that they become zero when you integrate, and that is indeed what happens. I'll stop there and keep going tomorrow.